It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. We who send soldiers to die, let us remember what they are like alive. For they do not begin as young dead soldiers. They begin vibrant and alive with their whole lives ahead of them. They are full of hope and full of future. Their marriages, children, and families are still ahead of them. All the challenges life brings, the successes, the failures, life's unpredictable array of comedies and tragedies still lie in their future. The whole hope and promise of life beckon to them. When we send them into war, we are promising them that this cause will be worth it, worth cutting off their lives for, worth dying for. If we cannot make that promise, we must not send them into war. Yet looking back just over our own lifetimes, how few wars there have been that rose to the height of actually being preferable to all those young, living soldiers. Just the pull of a trigger can end so many lives. But the most devastating trigger isn't on a gun. It's the trigger we pull when we send them into the meat grinder of wars that are not worthy of them, not worthy of our own or of America's highest and most honest ideals. We, too, pull the triggers that send the young to die. Let us remember the look and the feel of soldiers who are alive. And let us not be trigger happy. Amen. On the cover of your orders of service, you have the poem and the artwork of one of my very favorite poets, Piet Hein, who is a Danish poet who wrote five books of what he called grooks. He invented the word, and it meant witty, wise little poems with funny pictures with them. It's grooks. This one's one of my favorites. Put up in a place where it's easy to see the cryptic admonishment, TTT. When you think of how... depressingly. I can never remember that word. When you think of how depressingly slowly you climb, it's well to remember things take time. Some of this comes to mind just thinking back on Tuesday's election. But I'm not going to spend much time on Tuesday's election. The Proposition 2 passed by 76%, which should be enough of a message to teach everyone that it's being framed wrong. And it's never likely to succeed or anything like it as long as it's framed in terms of individual rights. And I will be talking about that. It's been a little over a year since I sat here and delivered the sermon called Living Under Fascism. And as that sermon took on a life of its own all over the internet, it spread to what are now thousands of sites. It also brought a book contract, a lot of radio interviews, the recent interview on the online version of the UU World, the recent award from the Austrian Chronicle, And I learned yesterday that the sermon was quoted at some length by a political writer in Sydney, Australia, in the Morning Herald, describing not America, but Australia's government. It's been a very strange year. Looking back a year later, I think the sermon's diagnosis was about on the mark, and that we are living under an American style of fascism. That fascism involves plutocracy, imperialism, and fundamentalism, and it's fundamentally changed some of the most important rules of life. If it's what we're living under, then we need to understand how to play under the new rules, because we can't play the same way we've played under the old ones. While these comments are very political, they're not partisan. Our slide into this American style of fascism grew continuously through the past four presidential administrations, both Republican and Democrat, the Clinton selling of both American and world workers through the WTO and NAFTA played an immense role in this, and as irate as people may be over the more than 100,000 Iraqi deaths in this invasion of Iraq, we need to remember that Bill Clinton's embargoes caused the death of between 500,000 and 1 million Iraqi deaths. This has been bipartisan. Neither party seems to have a clear or good answer. So today, a year after offering critiques and the sermon on fascism, I want to begin offering suggestions for operating in this brave new world order that looks more and more like 1984. In the rules of fascism, it is the state that matters, not individuals. We may not like the rules, but they've won the day. They control a majority of Congress, the Senate, both parties, more and more laws, and the media. This means that continuing to frame arguments, liberal arguments, any arguments, in terms of individual rights is suicide. Individual rights aren't valued under the new rules. Arguments now need to be framed differently. George Lakoff was saying this when he wrote his book, Don't Think of an Elephant, and throughout the country, liberals have hoped that that was going to be something simple, that he was just going to teach them clever words to say the same things and fool people. George and I were on one panel together, and I spent some time talking with him in California at another thing I went to this summer. And George is clear, as I'm clear, that it isn't that simple. It means the values that have carried the left for 30 years won't work anymore. Not just the tricky words need to be found to fool people. Arguments now need to be framed in terms of what is best for the state, for the good of the majority of Americans of all religious and political persuasions. We need to be people who want to serve the interests of our country and who try to persuade a majority of our fellow citizens to join us. I do not think we can convince either political party of this. I do not think we can convince the media of this. I think we need to focus on persuading the huge majority of Americans who've been disenfranchised. Now, the truth, you can go about this far in talking about politics before people's eyes glaze over. The truth is that 90 to 95% of you are not interested in and not going to spend much time in working on politics or political action, and I'm one of you. I don't see political action as very compelling either. It's not my myth. But each of us has something positive to offer, even if it's as undramatic as learning how to live healthy, joyful lives and not let our souls be poisoned by the spirit of the time. That alone may be one of the biggest gifts we can offer the world around us. How do we do this? The center for me has to be moral and ethical or religious and has to follow what I found to be the principal teachings of most honest prophets and sages of history, regardless of what brand of religion they're teaching. So I think the religious right is correct when they say we need to operate out of deep moral and ethical values and that we haven't done that. They call these values religious. Unfortunately, the style of religion they're using and the style of Christianity they're using is too narrow to do justice to ethics, to morality, or to America. You can't found an adequate moral background on a morality characterized by so much bigotry, so much exclusion, and so much hatred. And the truth is that we're not a Christian nation. We're the most pluralistic nation on earth. Only about 21% of Americans of all faiths attend religious services regularly. That means 4 out of 5 of Americans don't. You're sitting here in the minority of Americans. You got up on Sunday and got dressed and came to church. That's a minority. We're being led to believe that it's a majority. It's not. Now, there are 100 topics to talk about this morning, and I want to pick only 3, which will leave out most of your favorites. I want to talk about the word economics and economy. And I want to talk about politics and how to do it and how not to do it. And then finally, I want to talk about what's more important for me, which is, to put it in flat-out religious language, how do we save our souls? How do we save the soul of America? And how do we reconstitute the soul of the world? And all these things are tied together. The economy. We live in perhaps the most rapacious form of capitalism since at least the 1920s, if not the 1890s. It has been called by many writers on both sides of the political aisle an economy of greed. I think we need to be able to make the case why an economy of greed is bad for human life, for America, and for the world. The assumption since Ronald Reagan was president, now simply taken as true, goes about like this. It's a dog-eat-dog world, and the government needs to help the biggest and meanest dogs. With a few exceptions, like the first President Bush's raising taxes, which was an exception he doesn't get credit for enough, these rules have governed Reagan, the Clintons, and both Bushes. It's bipartisan, established in the assumptions of both parties, and it's wrong. Why is it wrong? Not because of the logic. The logic, as I want to show you, is really good. The logic is very tight. It's wrong because of its fundamental misunderstanding of what economics is about. We've been taught that economics is about numbers and profits. You need a calculator to do it. It's not what the word means. The Greek word from which we get economics has 2 parts. The ECO is the same word you find in ecology. It means home. And the nomos means rules or laws. Economics is about homemaking. It's about the rules for making a good home. That's what the word meant. It's not what it means today, but it's what the word meant. And the question for every system of economics, then, whether economists know how to ask it or not, is whether the rules of the current economics are making a good home for the majority of the citizens. If they aren't, it isn't good economics, no matter how the numbers add up. When you start with bad assumptions that economics is about profit-taking for the few rather than empowering the many, and you combine bad assumptions with really good logic, you get really logical bad results. Because when prophets count more than people, think through this with me. I think you've got to admire the logic. It really is good. When prophets count more than people, then we will turn people into things to serve prophets rather than turning prophets into things to serve people. And a lot follows from that, and very logically. Then it's perfectly logical to cut workers' pay and benefits. It's logical to ship jobs overseas to cheaper markets. It's logical to coerce poor areas of the world to get their people to work for as little as 13 cents an hour, maybe less, in inhumane working conditions that can't even buy them enough food. Their purpose in life is to create profit. And it's logical to support tyrannical regimes, which we've done for decades, because they can control their people as we milk them for cheap labor and other favors. All this is logical if profits for the few are more important than high standards of living for the many, because they've ceased to be people and they become things whose use is making profits for others and who can and should be discarded when there's a cheaper way to do that. It's perfectly logical to say that people don't deserve anything they can't afford to pay for, as large corporations have now been claiming and selling even water to poor people in South America. And it's logical to say that those who own the country should run it. And that quote is not new. That came from Chief Justice John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court over 200 years ago. These aren't new things. Just their ascendancy is new again. Now, since the masses, that's, well, you know, that's you. Since the masses won't like this new and degraded, somewhat subhuman role, no matter how logical it is, it's amazing how the masses can fail to see logic that's this clear. Then it's also logical to use public relations, advertising, and the media, and, when necessary, the police, to keep them in line, to keep them doing what they need to be doing to make this system work. Noam Chomsky has a book out called Manufacturing Consent, but he didn't make that phrase up. That phrase was made up over a half century ago by a very respected and decorated American psychologist named Edward Bernays. And when Bernays described the process of manufacturing consent, he meant it as a good thing. He said, this is how large democracies have to be run. This is the only way you can get the herd, the masses, to follow where the leaders want to go. You find ways through manipulating their thinking to manufacture the consent that you need. Now, that's brilliant. And this kind of manufacturing consent is now somewhat of a high art form, as you know. It's why both political parties have agreed, with the eager cooperation of the media, to avoid dealing with significant issues at all during presidential and many other elections. And just to distract the masses with attack ads, personalities, scandals, sleaze, and sensationalism. It seemed to me this started in the presidential elections big time in 1996. Some of you may want to take it back farther than that. It's logical to do this because attack ads and sensationalism, that's what I call car crash journalism, draws crowds. And advertisers like crowds. And as those who control the money control the laws, the presidents, the judges on major courts, it's logical to say that democracy is working. No matter what the majority of people may say. No matter whether we have the highest percentage of people in the developed world, about 40%, without health care, they don't deserve health care, they can't afford it. It's logical. And the estimated 18,000 Americans who die each year due to inadequate health care deserve to die. They can't afford the price of life. It may be brutal, but it's logical. I'm serious in saying this is logical. I think it's evil, but it's logical. And the task then is to persuade not the owners, not the politicians, and probably not the media, but the majority, that this is a bad definition of people. It's a bad definition of economics, a bad understanding of the healthiest relationship between people and money, and a mortal enemy of democracy and the greater good for the greater number of Americans. Christians, Jews, atheists, black, white, rich, poor, Democrats, Republicans, all of them. Our media keep telling us that what's driving our economy is the concern that we have an increasingly better standard of living. This just hasn't been true for a long time. Since 1980, with few exceptions, the vast majority of Americans have had increasingly worse standards of living. We have no savings, credit card debts of $10,000 to $14,000, fewer benefits, less job security, less health care, and less of a voice in the laws that are passed. And I read yesterday that our president has now borrowed more money, has put the United States into deeper debt than all previous 42 presidents combined. Now, no matter how you try to spin that, that is not an economy that is working, let alone making a safe and comfortable home for our citizens. It's not a partisan issue. These things aren't the result of progress. They came from valuing profits for the few over life for the many. It was that simple. That was an unwise and a greedy decision, and an evil one if human life has something intrinsic that has to be honored. So, since economics is supposed to be not the art of profit-taking, but the art of homemaking, we can argue that for the sake of the vast majority of our brothers and sisters in this great country, we have been subjected to a terrible definition of economics, an economy of greed, and that those terrible assumptions have harmed, even killed, people of all religious and political persuasions and of all ages. For the greatest good of the greatest number of Americans, we need to redefine economic priorities to make profit serve and empower the many rather than the few. And no, I don't think either political party will support this. And I don't think the media will support this. And the Christian Coalition will keep saying that the rich shouldn't be taxed and that social programs and health care should be taken away from all who can't pay for them. But the voices that might change these rules will have to convince the vast majority of our fellow citizens that the role of money is to serve them rather than the other way around. If that happened, it would be a revolution of the highest order. All right, now that all those problems are solved, politics. I want to use one recent experience I had here in Austin as a way to frame the whole subject of politics. Now, that can't be done, and it isn't wise, especially this experience. It was a rally I attended on November 2nd when I was asked to speak from the Capitol steps for a group working nationally to impeach President Bush. I spoke because I agree that the president should be impeached, and ironically, under the same charges that were used in the impeachment of Bill Clinton, lying and obstruction of justice. That's ironic. Several people from this church were there. I don't know how all of you experienced it, but for me it was a disgusting experience. The biggest signs I saw people carrying were simply vulgar and childish. I've left feeling dirty and wanting to get away from these people. The woman who organized that rally and invited me to speak at it came to see me Thursday so we could talk about these things. We had a very nice visit. I asked her if she really thought that such vulgarity would persuade others to want to associate with their cause. or whether it wouldn't instead make it easy for people to say that if this is the kind of people who are against Bush, they're glad they're for him. She said that they couldn't censor anyone and didn't want to exclude anyone. And besides, she knew their cause was right. So the rightness of it, she said, should attract many more people than the 200 or so who showed up at the little rally. This was a rally designed to bring out the whole University of Texas student body. 200 people. Without trying to pretend that one rally really represents politics at its best, I do think it points up some key errors the political left is making that the right is not making. One of them is thinking that this is about being right. It isn't about being right. It's about being persuasive. And that's different. The social and political right, in my view, is wrong. They're also very persuasive. And that's all it takes to take over a country. Another is thinking that being right allows you to be vulgar and uncouth and present a picture that no one wants to get near. And that's never true. I think one of the things we need to learn from are the civil rights movements of the 1950s and 60s. Some of us lived through them. Some of the rest of you have seen clips from them on television. Here's the image I'll bet you remember. The image of black people, mostly black, some white, marching in the hot summer in the South wearing white shirts and ties. This was not an accident. These were people who determined that their role was to raise the level of civility and dignity and never to be drawn down to the low and vulgar level of people who were calling them names, denying them rights, sometimes beating and killing them. That was noble. And I would argue that it was that image and that dignity and civility that won that civil rights battle, not their rhetoric. People looked at them for an image of America that they were selling and asked whether it was an image of America we wanted to be associated with, compared to the image of the people standing by the streets, calling them vulgar names and throwing things and beating them. And what most Americans decided was that we prefer an image of dignity and of civility. Now we've forgotten that. If those civil rights marchers, and I ask anyone who was there to see if you disagree with this, if those civil rights marchers instead had carried angry, vulgar, self-righteous signs and the people had dressed like slobs, the civil rights movement would have failed. I'm convinced of that. And that's a lesson we need to reclaim today. People who watch marches look to the character of the demonstrator more than they look to their signs. They're looking at the image and deciding whether these are the sorts of people they want to define America and whether these are the sorts of people they would want to be identified with. And if they're not, you've lost your cause. So, what's the solution? How do we save our souls? How do we save the soul of America? And how do we reclaim the soul of the world? It's no surprise to me, well, it can't be much surprise to you either, that for me the solution is always going to come back to a religious solution. Because what we're seeing in the civil rights marches of the 50s and what we're hearing in this language is that the solution to problems comes back to the religious questions that have been with us forever. And the questions are, how then shall we act in a world of people who think we are wrong, who don't like us, who hate us, who revile us? How then in that context shall we act? Shall we stoop to their level, or shall we raise the level above anything that they choose to do? And the rules for this have never changed. How do we live wisely and well, even in toxic times, without letting the times poison our own soul? We do it by trying to be a person of character, no matter what's around us. By trying to behave nobly, no matter how others around us are behaving. We remember that we do not do to others what we would not want them to do to us, and that includes calling them idiots, treating them like moral inferiors, and waving vulgar signs in their face. We act in ways that we could be proud of if the noblest people who ever lived were watching us. Acting in ways we could be proud of if God were watching us. It isn't about being right. It's about being decent and civil and noble and compassionate and persuasive. And these aren't just lessons for doing political action. They're lessons for living more wisely and well for the rest of us who aren't drawn to political action. Is this guaranteed to win dirty and vicious and unfair political battles? No. But it is guaranteed to help give you a character you can be proud of and guide you forward toward behavior that is a credit to you and a credit to the people who love you. You may lose the battle, but you will gain your soul. And this harkens back to Jesus' teaching about those who gain the world but lose their soul. By soul, I don't mean a little bag of air. By soul, I mean that which is at the center of you, the essence of what is most important about who you are. If we fight in ways that lose that, we have lost more than we can count. Life isn't about being right. Everybody thinks they're right. It's about being decent, noble, civil, respectful, compassionate, and persuasive. No matter how low others may drag the standards of behavior, we may not follow them there. First, we save our souls. Then we save the souls of our ideals, the picture of America that we care about. And then we try to reclaim the soul of the world. This won't be quick. Things take time. They also require intelligent, aware, and loving people of good character, acting in ways that are better than the ways others may be acting toward them, acting in ways that bring blessings to them and the world around them. It's our world. Let's begin to reclaim it with diligence and dignity.